like the Dallas Four. Cool it with tea. Cool, refreshing, iced tea. Easy to mix, tastes fabulous. Nothing cools you like the total taste of iced tea.
Now with me today, I have the inimitable Jim Ford, drummer of the Dallas Four. Welcome, Jim.
Welcome, yes.
Now, okay, how far back did you do you go with the Dallas Four, and when did you start with them?
Day one.
And how? Oh, really?
Day one.
Day one?
Yeah.
And how did that, were you all mates or something?
No, I never met Baz or Doddy. Two of us went from Daryl Legg and the Demons, dare I say it.
That's a great
Daryl Legg. Oh, God. Embarrassing name. But we went and met with Doddy and Baz, and that was it, basically. About 63, I think.
Okay. Because, yeah. Okay, now that leads us then into your first record in the Dallas Four, which was Silence is Golden, backed with Louis Louet. And I have 1964 as the date for that, so that pretty much fits.
64?
Yeah.
Okay, that was done at Stebbing's.
Saratoga Avenue.
Right, yeah. Oh, the basement.
Because that was a big... Did that single come out before the international one here, or was it just after, or...?
You mean the Tremolos?
Yeah, yeah.
No, they came out way later.
Oh, right.
Oh, that's a story in itself. I could write a book on that.
Because when you hear your version, it sort of sounds like their version, but...
Well, no, we did that years earlier.
But you did it earlier. That's interesting, yeah.
Well, we did that, then we went to Australia, 65, and we went with Graham Dent, who is our manager. But we ended up in great all sorts of drama over there, and when he finally returned, his peace offering was, I re-released your record. And therefore it came out again. I think that's the label we see now.
Oh, okay.
So it's not on the original label, Stebbing's. Zodiac, that would have been it, yeah.
Ah, so there's 45s out there with Zodiac.
Yep.
Well, that'd be nice to find.
I'm pretty sure there is. I can remember when the Dallas Four went to Sydney in 65, we stayed at a hotel called the Copenhagen in the Cross,
yeah.
A couple of doors down from the Rex, and in the basement of that was a band, and it were Eddie Lowe, John Rolls, and Billy Nuku on drums.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
I think there was Smashing the Googie and Boogie Walker, who were the Volcanics crew.
Oh, okay.
And they were actually, at that time, they were playing at the Rex, three doors up the road. So there was a mix of people between those two groups, you know. It was quite crazy.
Yes, well, there's a few like that out there, isn't there? You know, people that have gone on to bigger and better things.
Yeah.
That started off just working around town. I tell you what, I have a memory. My first memory of ever seeing the Dallas Four, it's funny, I've never forgotten it, and you'll know immediately when I tell you, was one lunchtime, I think, at the top floor of Farmers.
Oh, that's well into the piece.
Yes, it would
be. That was when we were doing all the vocal backings for Kevin Wall's TV show, the Pits and Clear thing.
Right.
Let's Go Happen and Come On, I think it was. And we did all, well, I thought we did all the backings, but apparently there are others that did them as well. But Kevin Wall produced that series
Farmers. I was on Happen In myself, yeah.
Good on you.
With Kevin, Kevin Wall.
Yeah, well, Kevin produced that. There's a series of fashion shows at the top of the Farmers. We used to do five shows a day there.
Oh, they were his productions, yeah.
He did the whole thing, you know, really sort of snap, crackle, pop, go, everything flat out, you know, typical Kevin Moore.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised.
No space is allowed.
Well, I know. Well, I'm quite surprised, you know, sitting here looking at this information and seeing that you guys it was back in 63, 64 when you kicked off, because that's right, I didn't come along until, because I'm a bit younger, and I didn't see you guys till, I guess it's 66, 67.
No, I think the first time I saw you was in the top 20.
Yes, that's right, I played the top 20. I've got pictures of that. Because we were the classic garage band in Mount Albert, and we were so proud that on the night when we were actually booked to play at the Platterack.
Oh, my God.
Where you guys were seasoned professionals.
Well, we started it.
and we were just the young... I mean, catching a taxi in at something like 11 o'clock at night was just unheard of for us young
boys. Didn't cost you very much, though, did it?
No, it didn't. And now, what I've got here on my little list is in 1965, it tells me here that you guys did a record, Bells of Rhymney and Thou Shalt Not Steal.
That was the first one, so that's the correction. That was the first one.
Oh, but
yes.
But
Bells of Rhymney was banned.
Was it?
I think we must have been the first band in New Zealand to have a record banned, simply because it was a protest song. It was a peaceful, beautiful little birds melody.
It is a great song.
It came from the birds, and it was just a lovely piece. But it was banned because it was a protest song.
And then I have That Man's Got No Luck.
Yeah, well, we did that, I think, with HMV in Wellington.
Okay.
I did that.
Okay.
That was my vocal.
Right.
Oh, God, that was dreaded. You were... Oh, that almost broke the band up.
It'd be lovely to find that.
I'd like to find that, but only for nostalgic reasons.
Yeah, right.
Because that nearly broke the band. Because when we did it down there, and when they made the copy of the record, they brought it down to us, and they had Jimmy Ford and the Dallas Four.
Oh, no.
I nearly fainted.
Oh,
where did that come from? And the other guys thought I'd rigged it up.
Oh, no.
And,
Oh, that's interesting. You tell us that.
That was hell broke loose.
Oh, yeah. In a band, that's a shocking thing if it hasn't been.
Well, the thing is, our whole thing as a band was no one is a front person in our band.
We were always like that, too.
Yeah, we were adamant that no one's going to take the front of it.
Jim Ford and the Dallas Four.
Oh, God. I paled into insignificance when I saw that. I kid you not. I thought you're trying to kill the band or promote it. Make up your mind.
Yeah, whose ever idea that was would have had no idea that the effect it was going to have.
Well,
you know?
No, he thought, well, you've got to have a name up front. I said, no, you bloody don't. That's what we're here for, you fool. You know? And I had to go. I went off at him, and I had to do it in front of all the others, too, because otherwise they're thinking, I planned it. No way. Oh. I was as surprised as they were.
Oh, well, I'm glad you cleared that up. We can't have that.
I don't think it was ever really cleared. Well, that was the rule. We set it out in the beginning. We said, no one fronts this band. We had two other front people, but they sang with us. The first one was Leo DiCastro.
Right, I saw that somewhere.
He is the best singer I ever heard in my life.
I remember Leo.
He was way.
I believe he's still out there too, you know.
I think
Australia.
He is. Yeah, most likely. But he was the best singer I ever heard. And so we used him because he used to come to the Platterack and he'd sing backing vocals. Within weeks, he copied every one of our parts.
Right.
And he sung them louder and better than we did. And we thought, we've got to use this guy.
Oh, okay.
But he was too much the country boy.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Henderson, who was managing it then, bought him on those silver suits, you know, shiny suits. And Leo'd go off the weekend up north.
Yeah.
He'd come back with no jacket. Oh, that's right. The jacket had the sleeve ripped out of it. And the trousers were all covered in mud from the bottom 6 inches, trapsing through some swamp up there. And he turned up on the Wednesday. We're supposed to be there on the Sunday, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that was Leo. You know, we loved him. But as a singer,
course,
he was untouchable. He really was.
Oh, that's great. Mm. And then in 1967, I see you've done White Christmas.
I think that was about the time. I think it was HMV again.
We actually did an album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, did it in Viking.
So somewhere there could be some
stuff. Well, I want to find that because we did it in 36 hours. And it was all covers, you know.
Yeah.
But it was typical Dallas Force, the stuff we played on stage, basically. White Christmas, I can't remember whose idea that was. It was some promoter's idea.
Well, Jim, and yes, so many times I can remember, you know, you guys as a band, there'd be the party pieces, you know. Ragdoll would have been one of them, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and Silence is Golden, the stuff you'd do live, there'd be some songs that would absolutely just stop everyone in their tracks, you know.
Well, we were doing the close vocal harmonies, which no one else was game enough to do. That became our little avenue, you know.
That's the whole thing about it. As a matter of fact, I can tell you, as a young band, we became influenced a little bit. And there was a time there, I think when we were called Omnibus, we started doing a whole lot.
I remember that.
Yeah, we started doing a whole lot of hard. In fact, somewhere here, I've got a recording of us doing See You in September. And I know you guys did that. I'm sure you did.
I'm not sure. Okay. We might have. We were at the Monaco, we were racking them off at five a day. You know?
Right.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
We used to do a sort of a top 20 type thing there with Keith Adams when he was doing the comparing there. And we have a big list of songs on the front of his rostrum. It had 480 songs, and they're all vocal harmonies except for the odd Shadows instrumental, you know, the Apaches and the like.
Yeah.
The rest were all four part harmony vocals.
Wow.
And we just racked them off, you know.
I know, and you were just so good at it. There was no one else could touch you on that. I mean,
well, we did it all day, every day.
That's right, and you were just polished as.
Yeah, back in those days, we were playing seven nights a week and up to three different places in the week and sometimes three places in the night.
That's right.
And then we'd do all the TV backings up at the TV studios on Shorten Street.
And that's the thing about the Dallas Four. I mean, you know, you didn't write your own material. You didn't...
Not much, no.
No, but that's not important in this case. What you is that's right, you were that close vocal harmony thing that just blew everyone away, and you know, you could do it like it seemed to us at the time, like only overseas bands could do it, you know.
Yeah, well, it's the whole thing was you just practice.
Mm.
When we were at the Monaco, we used to practice 5 days a week, I think.
Wow.
Well, near enough. But we learned five new harmony songs in that time, you know.
Yes,
and by the time we'd done it like two or three times, it started to change into the way we would do it rather than the way it was to start with.
Oh, yeah, a lot of bands
and it became our own version straight away, you know.
Of course they do, yeah. And I think my memory is mainly of the Dallas Fours when Graham was in it. But of course you would have had other members before.
Oh, we had a few.
Yeah.
I think at one stage I counted them through and I think it got to 11.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Before I ran out of ideas.
Okay, yeah.
But we won't go through all of them.
No, no.
But Graham was the last.
Graham Gill, yeah.
Well, no, he wasn't the last, actually. He was the last of our high-profile period.
I sailed that ship all alone until the day that I'm making home. I said, Louie, Louie, me gotta go. I said, Louie, Louie, me gotta go.
My cold has magically gone suddenly, and as a coincidence, around about the same time, in walks Graham Gill, another member of the Dallas Four. So while he's here, I'm going to ask him a few questions. Graham, just tell me again when you started with the Dallas Four. When was that?
It would have been in 1967, Larry. I was playing in a group at the time with my brother, a group called The Rogues. And the Dallas Four asked us to fill in for them while they were overseas. So we had to do a couple of weekends at the Platterack to cover for them. So they'd been doing a bit of researching around to find a group that was similar to doing similar material. But of course, they didn't want anyone that was too good that would show them up, so that they chose us because we were rather
Right, you you would work, yeah. Yeah, that still happens to this very day, I think you'll find, you know, here and there. Oh, well, that's good. So, because that explains, I've said this to Jim Ford, but I remember clearly going up to the top of Farmers and seeing the Dallas Four, and I'm sure you were in the band then, so that must have been around then, 67.
Yeah, I think I'd been in for quite a while when we did the Farmers gig. And
might have been 68, perhaps, yeah.
Still got a photo of that.
Right.
Yeah, with the Go-Go Girls, and I think Gwen Owen might have been there as well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just to think I might start writing a song to that background track of a bulldozer buzzing away next door. Seems to phase in and out, doesn't it? All right, so...
Can you dig it?
Yeah, can you dig it? Now, because then I remember, of course, you guys playing at the Platter Act. I remember that very well. And the speciality you all had of those wonderful close harmonies. So did you have a day job around then? I mean, did you have to give up a day job to be in the band and all that? Because you did a lot of work, didn't you?
I did have a day job, and one of the prerequisites for joining a group was that I resigned from that. I was pretty excited because I was 19 at the time, and I also had to shift into the band's flat.
In the
Hyber building.
Yes, I remember those. That's I never went there, but I worked over the road, you see. You probably didn't know that. I was in a printing shop just over the road.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you would have been used to seeing people hanging out the windows.
Oh, yeah, there were people coming and going, definitely.
Well, we used to have Chris Parkinson was a regular visitor, and he always tried to shock us by hanging by his fingers out the window.
Oh, so did he?
People across the other side of Dominion Road would be in horror that there was this guy look on the third floor just hanging by his hands out the window, and that's Chris Parkinson.
Yes, I know Chris. I know Chris. He's still out there. Voice, a hierarchy voiceover personality.
That's right.
Extraordinaire.
Yeah.
Yep. Loves to race his mini.
He does.
You were there till the end of the band?
Not really. It sort of... I originally came in replacing Jimmy Elliott, and the Dallas Four were already renowned for the close harmony work. So as my initiation, I basically had to listen to a lot of recordings where they'd isolated Jimmy's voice and basically said, here's this falsetto part.
Wow.
You've got to learn that. And so I spent a lot of time with headphones on just following Jimmy's parts.
Well, and, okay.
So that was a bit of a challenge for me to... fortunately, I'd done a bit of work on vocals with the Rogues, so it didn't appear too onerous, but it was quite...
it would be, yeah.
It was quite a development in my vocalising.
Yeah.
And also... I'd been a guitarist up until then. I'd been a rhythm guitarist, and I was expected to learn organ in the space of about 2 weeks.
Yes, I remember you playing that.
So
yeah.
I had a Vox organ, and Doddy just showed me, here's the fingering for the chords.
Wow.
And here's a chart. Go for it. So when I look back, I think, that wasn't the easiest initiation, but obviously it developed my skills to a point where instead of just playing by ear, I had to follow rudimentary charts.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, come and join the band, learn these parts, and by the way, learn another instrument as well.
it was certainly a lot of fun in that 2 to 3 years that I was there, but I think we all eventually just got a bit tired of playing something like 6 nights a week, and sometimes you'd start at Monaco between 8 and 12, and then you'd go off to a nightclub and you'd play through till 4 o'clock.
So it was a lot of work, wasn't it? A lot of work. Even I did that, although not as regularly as you probably, but that's right. What a lot of work that was.
And I think at some point we all moved on with our lives. I got married, and it certainly wasn't going to work.
No.
With working those sort of hours. So I think I finished up in around late 1969.
Okay. What do you remember about the clubs? I mean, you did the Platterack and what the Monaco, yeah.
Yeah, we probably did the whole lot. We did the top 20 as well, round the corner at Montmartre and Mojo's. What sticks in my mind is that the people from all sorts of nightlife were there at that late hour. You'd get the strippers down from K Road, and the sailors when they were in town.
Vietnam on R&R, yeah.
Yeah, you almost had that sleazy element, but those people were nevertheless ordinary people.
It was never a problem, was it?
No, they weren't. Everyone was there just because they'd probably worked in the earlier part of the night in the entertainment industry, and they were ready just to
be normal,
sit back and have a bit of a relax.
I remember stuff like that too. We had very unusual nights. Our band, we used to do Monday and Tuesday night at the Bo Peep till 3 or 4 in the morning, and then go to work at 8 o'clock. Unbelievable. But that's the sort of crowd we'd get early in the week. Would be sailors and strippers here. Well, that's great, Graham. Well, thank you for that. Appreciate you just stepping into this and just giving another little slant on it.
I appreciate it myself, Larry, and it's been great doing some work in your studio.
Thank you.